You're listening to the Inspire Excellence Podcast, recorded at the BVA headquarters with your hosts, Kevin Miller and Tommy Ahlquist. Each episode is focused on shedding new light on different perspectives to create dialogue that inspires excellence.
And welcome once again to another podcast, Inspiring Excellence, Inspire Excellence. Tommy Ahlquist, Kevin Miller. Tommy, good to have you with us once again.
Yeah, we're looking forward to this next guest. This is going to be exciting. We've had Matt Schneider on our list for a long time to talk about because not only is he a former law enforcement SWAT team member, a lot to talk about there just with law enforcement and kind of appreciation for what you did in that part of your life, but also a small businessman. Mm-hmm. And we'll get into that, but also Second Amendment, gun rights, gun protection, a lot to talk to you about. And that's why you'll be such a great guest today. So thanks for coming on, Matt. And we'll get started by just asking you, Matt, tell us a little bit about yourself and just a little bit about your background before we get into some of the great things you're doing.
Where to start? First of all, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's always an honor when you get asked to come in and share your story. So I appreciate being on the show. I basically start at from Idaho for the last 25 or so years. Graduated high school in Idaho Falls. Any listeners in Idaho Falls?
What high school?
Skyline High School. Yeah, class of 2000. Shortly after high school, I self-sponsored through the police academy through Pocatello State University. And that was a 9-month program. It was really to sort of feel out whether or not law enforcement was the direction that I wanted to go as a profession, and graduated from it. And really liked what I saw and felt and learned when it comes to being a role player in a defense mechanism in the community between those that would cause harm and those that just want to live their life in peace and pursue the American dream. So then after that, I moved to Boise and went to Boise State. Was hired on by the Ada County Sheriff's Office in 2006. And then, yeah, I held a variety of different roles there. Started out in the jail, just over a year in the jail. Then went to patrol, a few years on patrol. Then I tried out for SWAT. I made the SWAT team. I spent 5 years as an entry guy on that team. And then as collateral duties, I was tasked with, or I was a task force officer with the U.S. Marshal's Office on a fugitive apprehension team. And then I did about a year undercover narcotics. And then about 10 years into the job, I was down in Newport Beach, California with family for a wedding. And I got bit by the entrepreneurial bug. And that was really from going to rent a beach cruiser bike with my wife. And it came up by a retired firefighter who owned it at the time that it was for sale. He was selling it for $40,000. And up to that point, I had never thought about owning my own business or doing anything other than law enforcement. But when he said that, something changed. And I became very inquisitive as to what does this mean to sell a business and what does this $40,000 get me? And started digging into it a little bit. And what I found was that, and this person shall remain nameless to protect his identity, but he said, listen, I'm asking $40,000. You're going to have to trust me that it's worth every bit of that. But what you have to understand is that California is very heavy in taxes. And this is a majority cash business. So the amount I report may not actually reflect the amount I make. So my books aren't necessarily correct. That's a major red flag, right? So I wasn't an entrepreneur, but I know just enough about tax law to know that that's probably not a good direction to go. But then on the drive home, the wheels were turning. And the entire drive, my wife's looking over at me and I'm just staring off into the distance. And she's asking, what are you thinking about? I said, I don't know. She's like, I don't like that. And that's where the mental creation of what would become Forward Movement training and consulting, it came from that drive. So we opened up that business in 2013. I'm sure we'll get into it and have been rocking and rolling ever since.
We will get into it because I think it's fascinating. Before we get there, tell us a little bit because of the guests we've had growing up in Idaho Falls. What drove you to get into law enforcement? first responder, but first responder with a different twist to it. I mean, you're going to go into something where you're going to put yourself in danger every day. Were there people that inspired you or people that you knew of? What was the motivation to make that career choice right out of high school?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You know, some kids, I think they grow up wanting to get into law enforcement. They think about themselves as police officers, as youngsters. That wasn't my case. What happened was I was in my senior year of high school and I was a bag boy at Albertsons and I was dating the bakery girl, but that spark just wasn't there between us. But the checker, one of the checkers, Lincoln at McDonald, he'd taken a fancy to this bakery girl. And I said, listen, things aren't really there for us. Let me make an introduction to you. Well, they hit it off. The spark was there for them. They ended up getting
married. Introduced your current girlfriend to the checker.
That's what guys do. They just when things aren't working out, you just say, hey, that's the whole point of dating, right? Is just to figure out is there chemistry or not. And when there's not, you talk to a buddy who's got interest and send it on its way. But they hit it off. They ended up getting married, having a family. He became a police officer with Idaho Falls Police. And I guess as a thank you, he got a hold of me and said, hey, I'm now a cop. You want to go on a ride along? Mm. So I went out on a ride along with them for a few hours. And at this point I had just graduated, you know, and so we're cruising around Skyline and he's like, hey, you know, you still know some of the juniors or seniors there? I'm like, yeah, you know what they drive. He's like, we'll make sure if they commit a violation that we'll stop them. And we cruised around the city and we did parking violations and, you know, traffic stops. There was nothing of any significance that happened, but sitting in that patrol car and seeing that position of being able to really make a difference at any moment, it could go to a lights and sirens thing and you're helping somebody save a life, or you could be dealing with a barking dog call, or it could be whatever. And that's what sparked it for me. But as I started doing research and when I found that Idaho State University had their program, I decided I would continue to further my understanding of the profession before I started trying to get into it. But yeah, Link McDonald, because he married the bakery girl.
It's all about the transaction. And when we take a look at the last few years of law enforcement, they've been under siege during the previous administration. What does it take to do what some people call a thankless job? Because you've got everybody with your little video camera trying to get on Inside Edition, provoking people, and police officers have to have superhuman restraint.
It is tough. It is an extremely tough thing when it comes to people thinking they know, but having no idea. And when it comes to law enforcement, I think it's completely different today than it was before the advent of social media and, you know, body cams and things, from the standpoint of truly at the speed of thumbs, an event can be broadcast around the world. And we live in a society where everybody becomes very passionate about their opinion, regardless if it's educated or not. And they'll watch this video and they'll see one perspective in a two-dimensional world from a position of comfort in their own living room. And they decide right there whether it was right or wrong, they support or don't support. And, Facebook is one of the largest quote unquote news media outlets out there. And so many people get their quote unquote news from social media, or you have these major outlets that, you know, they're agenda driven. It just depends on which agenda they want to drive. In law enforcement are dealing with societies where they think they know, but they don't know. Now, how we get through it though is that the naysayers always seem to be the loudest, but the supporters are the greatest. And so we understand and know that truly the number of people that support what we're doing far outweigh the naysayers do. And what's interesting is as these major events happen, like Ferguson, the riots in Ferguson, the hands up, don't shoot. Well, we know that was not the case, right? We know after the fact, there was no hands up, don't shoot. That was a complete knee jerk reaction, in a society that allowed for it to happen because the higher ups were saying, just let them do their thing. And it was all based off of total garbage. But when those things happen, society steps up. The supporters, the larger number step up. And what's crazy is the number of meals that start showing up, or pastries, or thank you notes, or just others that will wave and show appreciation. And that's what constantly reminds law enforcement, you know, why they're doing what they do, and that they truly are supported.
One more follow-up on that question for you is, for me, you know, 18 years in the ER, I mean, I spent most of my my time was with law enforcement. I mean, that's just where you interact.
Yeah.
And in 18 years, never had anything that wasn't professional, unbelievably positive experiences, both with my interactions with law enforcement in general, and my observation of how law enforcement would treat these patients, because you know, they'd bring in all sorts of people on all sorts of things in all sorts of situations.
Right.
And I can honestly say never one time of hundreds and hundreds of interactions had anything negative. So I've always had a tremendous amount of respect. And the second part of that is, you know, when I would get something into the ER, it was always sanitized. It was always, sure, you know, you think about it, the acute event was already over. Uh-huh. Whatever happened. It was packaged by EMS and by law enforcement, and then it would be delivered, right? So I had built into me deeply a deep respect and appreciation and friendship and gratitude for law enforcement that I'll carry with me always. But I believe also in Idaho, you know, I think we live in the greatest country in the history of the planet, in a state that I hope, and as I travel the state, I think people in this state love law enforcement, see them as the first responders and protectors and servants that they are. Did you feel that way being in law enforcement? Because you were in undercover narcotics, you were in SWAT team, you were in patrol, you were in jail. But was that your experience for your career in law enforcement?
Yeah, for sure. You know, all of my experiences in Idaho, and you know, I'm not naive enough to say that there aren't departments in other states around this fine country where there are problems, and there are things that are being allowed to be done or things that are not corrected. There's problems with leadership. There's problems in local government, whatever. I know that there are people who wear the uniform throughout the country that shouldn't be. But we live in Idaho, and I have never worked with one of them. And while I can say that there are probably people out there in other states that that are dealing with that, and communities that are dealing with that, they do not represent the majority. They represent the small fraction, just like active shooters, right? Every time there's an active shooter event, there's this massive outcry. One person carries out one catastrophic event, atrocious event, evil event, and the country goes bonkers. And it's the same thing in law enforcement. We got one person, one dirty cop, one corrupt cop, or maybe a couple of them, you know, in an agency that do something really stupid, that blackens the eye of the entire profession throughout the country. We don't support those people. And we believe, like the rest community believes, that if you have a corrupt cop or you have somebody that's out there doing something it shouldn't be doing, they are charged with every law that they broke to the fullest extent of the law, plus a few extra, because they know they should know better. We don't support them, but Idaho is different. And I feel very, very blessed to have done my law enforcement days here, surrounded by truly people that suit up every day. And that includes EMS and fire and other, you know, first responders. They suit up every single day. I've never interacted and worked a shift in any event with any of them that weren't truly there to absolutely make a better difference in their community.
You know, we all watch the movies.
Sure.
You guys live the life. I watch the movies. So I think what everyone would like to know is, how do you go undercover?
That's a great question, partner.
Well, without giving out the secrets, because that would be problematic to my undercover colleagues, I'll tell you, it's not like the movies. None of it is like the movies. Believe it or not, if someone's buying cocaine and they're like, is this powdered sugar or is this real coke? They don't wipe it on their gums. They don't do a little sample in the car, you know. Is this crystal meth or is this just, you know, shards of something other? They don't put it in the pipe. And I'll say that criminals are dumb. We have some very long standing undercovers who have been doing the job for a long time and have done some very, very extensive cases and put a lot of people in prison, and they're still incredibly successful.
Sure. That was a great dodge. However, back to the point, with all due respect, see, again, if somebody like me tried to be undercover, I would forget my cover.
Yeah. Yeah.
And psychologically, going from a mindset of law enforcement, duty, protection, community, service, to becoming a nefarious criminal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, it's an interesting balance that we play for sure. In the training is how to ride that line oftentimes. You know, there was plenty of times where I'm text messaging a person of interest and the text messages are going back and forth and we're talking the talk and setting things up. And, my wife would walk in the room and she'd see, you know, something. She's like, who are you talking to? And I'm like, oh, this is whoever. And she's like, you don't ever talk like that around our friends or family. Like, I'm not talking to friends or family, you know? So we play the part. Now, when we're conversing with them, we are acting as a dealer. And so it's a balance, but you are always reminded that you're still a cop, because when you do the deal, you're bringing it back to the evidence room and all of the forms are there and everything's got to weigh out and everything's got to test. And you're always thinking about the legal aspect because you're thinking about the courts. So even when we set up a deal, you go into it thinking as a cop, because there's an ultimate outcome that we want, which is to take this person moving drugs across our streets and poisoning our friends and family in the community. We want them to go to prison for as long as possible. And we know that in this country where everybody's afforded an attorney, we're going to trial, or we're at least going to court. We're going to suppression hearing. We're going to whatever. And so that's always in the back of our mind, even when we have gross beards and pierced ears and dirty clothes and talking the talk. But we have far more interaction with law enforcement, with our counterparts and with our, you know, our colleagues than we ever do with the dirties.
Would you forget your cover?
I probably would.
I would.
I'm with you.
It's too dangerous to forget your cover. They paint the picture as to what happens if you're exposed. We deal with people would be amazed at the extent of drug activity in our streets here. And they would be appalled to understand the kinds of people that bring it in and the kinds of people that are here that move it.
So that's a perfect shift, because there's a lot I want to get to with you. I want to make sure we get all this in. So, you know, this is a Second Amendment state. I like to think that we lead the country in thought and awareness. And, you know, I think we do a pretty good job defending that constitutional right for the right reasons. And you've created a business, Forward Movement Training Center. It's It's fascinating. I love it. And I love the idea and the concept. So tell us, so you see all these bad people that you just brought up. You see this challenge for the community, this scary things that are out there. We have the Second Amendment with people that have the right to protect themselves.
Right.
And you see a business opportunity.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, because not only do I think it's fascinating, but I think it's super important to people listening out there that may have strong opinions, but say there is this gap in the middle. Okay, I want to protect myself. I believe in the Constitution. I know there are bad people out there. Boom. Is that what happens in that drive home?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I'm thinking about what could I do after, getting bit by that entrepreneurial bug, my thought process was around what I knew well enough to where it would provide value to others, where that value would be exchanged with money. But it was really law enforcement centric at that time, because at that point I had, I had 5 years as a SWAT guy and a couple of years as a fugitive guy with, the US Marshals and, undercover stuff. And so I was thinking about how do I better help them? I was very fortunate with some of the teams I got to train with and places I got to go and exposure to other really high level training that's out there, as most specialty guys are in their agencies. But my head was really there. Once we opened, that's when I really started to understand the magnitude of the civilian population that was really deeply involved and interested with self-defense. Prior to that, in law enforcement, my gun-toting components were all as a cop. I didn't even conceal carry when I was, before I was a cop, because I came in young. But once we saw the demand.
So you started as a training center where you train law enforcement.
Well, we were always open to the public, but my thought process as far as where the company would go, the vision, the model, the projections were all, I would say 80% on the government side, law enforcement and military. But we've always been open to the civilian side because we always thought that would be cool if there was opportunity. It took me 6 months to open up, and that was going through an SBA route. I mean, it was very quick. And there was no model like ours for me to try to pull numbers from. I mean, Forward Movement is a very unique company. I'm too much of a doer, and I take too much massive action, which is again, the kinds of things that drove me to those specialty units where things were more dynamic and went boom. I just went with it. Like, this is what I know. And then I learned there's a major opportunity here to help educate self-defenders.
Yeah. Tommy, I have to apologize. I have to come back to how do you catch a fugitive, but that's coming up. Keeping on the entrepreneurial mindset, when you're in law enforcement, you get your check all the time, you do overtime, it's consistent, it's reliable, it's dependable. And then that transformation to go, boom, I'm out there, I'm rolling, and I've got to generate, and then I've got to figure it out, and I've got to do the taxes, I've got to get employees.
Yeah.
Can you share with us that process?
Well, yeah, that's the truth. I mean, I had a lot of certainty when it came to, my job with the sheriff's office. I knew without a doubt, every 2 weeks, my check would be in the account. I knew what my insurance would look like. I knew what my retirement looked like. I mean, there was a lot of certainty there. There was also a lot of uncertainty, right? Every time you go out and you do a deal, you do a SWAT operation, whatever, that's uncertain how that's going to end up. And that uncertainty was troubling for my wife, like it is for virtually every first responder spouse, and those that care for them. When I transitioned to the entrepreneurial side, I took those components of understanding that there's some certainty and then there's some uncertainty to it. But I'd never been an entrepreneur. My degree is in psychology. It's not in business. And so the learning curve was massive.
Can you, a couple of quick questions?
Yeah.
Because a lot of people listening out there. So here you have this idea, this epiphany.
Yeah.
You're coming back. Great idea. business opportunity. Did you have a business coach? Who did you surround yourself with? Because it's a that's a scary deal. Mm-hmm. When you start going into, okay, I'm going to go open this up. I'm going to put my dollars at risk. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go live the American dream. But you know, the statistics of small businesses that open, you know, it's abysmal. You know, right. There's a lot of great ideas, but most of them shut their doors. So tell us who you surrounded yourself with.
So I leveraged the SBA. The SBA's got a SCORE program, and I was aligned with a coach with them, and they won't write your business plan for you, but once it is written, they'll assign a coach to you, and then they will redline it. They'll just redline the heck out of it and help you understand how projections should be put together, how to read a P&L, how to generate, you know, revenue, and how to present something for the banks to take a look at and see what it is that they want to see. So the SBA offers a lot of free courses I took advantage of, and their coaching component of it. And then shortly after I opened, I realized that there was a need to know much more, because it was not quite like hard work pays off. Mm-hmm. Well, hard work may or may not pay off, as you know, right? How much work did you put into that election, right? And hard work may or may not pay off from the standpoint of our idea of where we want to be. In the end, though, it always seems to work out for the better. And I joined a couple of mastermind groups and started surrounding myself with other highly successful entrepreneurs that had been in the game for a lot longer. And they started coaching me. And so I've been a part of a mastermind group for the last 4 years, and I've learned a tremendous amount. That.
What was day one like? Fresh paint, open the door. Hey, everybody.
Quiet. It was like, let's rock and roll. And I'm checking my Google Analytics. Nobody's on the website. And I'm like, the phone is hooked up, but it's not ringing. No emails coming to the inbox. It was interesting. You know, I had realistic expectations, but at the same time, we're like,
sure.
Okay.
You get excited.
You guys are so excited. Yeah. I was really excited because what is the future hold? Right. Like where
you're all in. You're all in.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was very exciting, to not have a ceiling anymore of where I could go, what direction I could take it. You know, the path, you know, the journey. I mean, it was all up to me, which was really exciting to think about. And then also really troubling at the same time, because I knew most businesses fail their first year. Yeah. And so that's where I started to think, there's this marketing thing I better figure out.
For our listeners that are out there, having started multiple businesses, it's the most important thing you come to when you open up, and I'm sure this happened for you, and we can talk probably a lot about this, and it happens often, is what you thought was going to happen, right? That pro forma that was in that business plan, and what actually happens is it's just always different.
Always,
you can guarantee yourself one thing: it's not going to go as planned. And I think whoever can be nimble, react, find those profitable areas of the business early. I look at some of the ones I've started, and when I started down the road where I thought I was going to make money on the business, turned out to be a complete dud. Mm-hmm. And then where you ended up either finding it or not, because you have to find it. Cause once that idea of, okay, here's where I'm going to make my money. And I'm sure we could sit and talk to you for a long time, but I wanted our listeners to know that when you go into these things, go into it knowing I'm going to be ready. I'm in the ready stance, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And I'm going to be ready to react. I'm going to be nimble. I'm going to watch my balance sheet, because you can blow through a lot of money chasing an area of business that isn't profitable. And the success rate goes up if you can chase the profitable areas of the business that may or may not have been in your plan. Did you have any of those things when you started?
Oh, countless. I look at my business plan now, you know, over 5 years, and that business plan didn't match up with what was actually happening 6 months into us being open. You know, I contribute that really to the fact that we didn't have other models to look at and pull data from. But, you know, when you talk about being nimble and resilient, you know, having massive work ethic, I put in hours in the office, you know, the first 2 years that, I mean, it didn't even cast a small shadow. I cast a massive shadow over what I did at the sheriff's office. And, I knew that I wasn't, the failure was not an option. That was just ingrained in me on the SWAT team and in law enforcement in general and part of my personality. So yeah, I definitely experienced that. I'd be interested to know an entrepreneur who has not experienced that.
Yeah. It's one of the true blessings of that come through being an entrepreneur is learning that about yourself.
Yeah.
And it's where most of your character gets built is getting into it and knowing that, hey, this could be tough. And a lot of people fail because when that happens, they don't react well. Just looking at our time, I really want to get into a couple of things. Yeah. It's going so fast.
I know.
So for a lot of listeners out there, can you just take us through what your company does and how important training is if you're wanting to protect yourself? And that's having visited your shop. That's everything from someone that wants to have a gun in a drawer next to a in a nightstand next to a bed to someone that may conceal carry, which a lot of us do. Mm-hmm. To understanding the laws and understanding that it's not just, you know, having a gun, but it's being prepared to react. When I came and did the training at your facility and walked through it, one of the things that's always stuck through with me is that you said, when you go through your training scenarios, it's the males that fail because they want to chase the guy, right? Because they have all these scenarios that they can take you through. They had, you know, mock homes and banks and cars and all these things, but you're really trying to stay safe. The whole idea of protecting yourself is protecting you and your family, but staying safe. So get us into the importance of training for those people out there who are listening, who may own a firearm, but maybe wondering, how do I get ready to use it and prepared?
Yeah. So the way we really approach it is first just an acknowledgement that, you know, people oftentimes blame the weapon. Right. When it comes to controversy around guns, it's because they're blaming the tool and not looking at the person that used it for evil. When we can acknowledge the fact that the person with evil intent is more problematic than the tool they use to carry out that evil intent, we start to all level the playing field. One thing that we can all agree on is that evil exists. No community is exempt from it. No person is exempt from it. It exists. And it's not so kind to send a note and say, just FYI, tomorrow at about 3:28 PM, I'm going to go ahead and rob you. Right. Or, you know, you probably want to stay away from this place on this day because there's going to be an active shooter event. It just exists. And we acknowledge that. You have people who take up self-defense as a part of their lifestyle when they not just acknowledge it, but they're ready to be an active role player in defending themselves from the evil that exists and help to safeguard their loved ones as well from it. Once somebody makes that decision that they want to become a self-defender and attach a firearm, a lot of the times we do all kinds of different kind of training, but particularly with the firearm, when they attach a self-defense scenario to that, meaning it's in the drawer in the house, just in case someone were to kick in the door in the middle of the night, or I carry concealed just in case I'm at Walmart and I hear shots fired or there's robbery. When people make that attachment to the firearm, it's no longer just a tool. It's not a competition gun. It's not a plinking gun. It is a tool that carries with it the potential of taking life. That tool should become an extension of the person, whatever it is. It's just an extension of who they are. One of the first challenges that we have to get over more times than not when it comes to working with self-defenders is people don't know what they don't know. And they get a firearm and they think they're ready. Or they read a book, like, you know, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. They read his book on combat or on killing, or they watch a movie and they think that they know. They think they know what it would be like to be in a gunfight. They think they know what it'd have to be like to make a split second
lethal. So I'm going to tell a story when Matt completely embarrassed me. So I go visit his shop and they have a full simulator. Okay. That you're standing in front of it's a very high tech simulator where they throw a scenario at you and you have a firearm and you react real time and they record everything you're doing. And not only that, but you had your whole crew there watching me stand there, and it shook me to my very core.
Yeah.
You didn't give me a lot of warning. You said, okay, here's your firearm.
Criminals don't.
Something's going to happen. Yeah. You react as if you would react right now. And it was an active shooter deal and a robbery. And I was in the middle of it. And it was,
did you take him down?
I was pretty accurate, but I failed miserably. I did everything wrong, but it was just coming so fast and reacting so quickly. And at that moment I thought, oh my goodness, I didn't know what I didn't know. And this is, you know, different than just, hey, I've got I have a firearm in my car. I'm carrying one too. And I'm going to be ready to protect my kids.
Yeah.
To, oh my goodness, I'm not ready. I'm not ready if anything that happens here. So
yeah,
it really resonates what you said, because you hear that a lot, but boy, with that simulator, you're able to be put in that situation where you go, oh, there's a lot of work to be done here.
Yeah, for sure. You know, the reason why the simulator and training is so valuable is because the brain doesn't have the ability to separate simulation from reality. So in the amygdala, where fight or flight is housed, when the brain starts processing stimuluses that are problematic and it's challenging safety or survivability, it automatically goes into the amygdala. And it's not in a different place when you're in front of a shooting simulator as it would be in a real event. It's in the exact same place. As long as the context is built correctly, you go to that place. The reason why Call of Duty doesn't put you in that place, but our shooting simulator does, is because by design, you know, it's a $70,000 system. By design, it is created to put you in that place based on the realism, based on being told why you're there and giving your brain structure as to your involvement with what you're about to be involved in. And when once you're in that place, and you're experiencing the fight or flight component of it, it is much, much different than what anybody ever thought it might be. And that's a very important thing. That is very valuable to those that have that recognition, because the first element of consciousness is that unconscious incompetence. You don't know what you don't know. As soon as you're exposed to something like what you're talking about, a conscious incompetence, that is a gift to people, because the knowing that you're not nearly as prepared as you thought you were, it allows for you to now take action to get yourself past that place. When somebody arms themselves, that's not a personal decision. If somebody were to be armed and challenged and they go to a time where they can no longer prepare, but now they need to perform, and they're put in that place where they need to make that split second decision. The law is very clear. It's like a light switch. It's on or off. If somebody breaks the law in any way, they are 100% criminally liable for that. Now, if they don't violate any law in any way, there is zero criminal liability for it. When somebody either breaks a law, or they get themselves injured or killed, there is a whole network of people that care for them in an incredible way that is exposed to the outcomes of that decision-making. And whether it's just financial devastation from trying to keep themselves from going to prison, so they're leveraging everything that they've worked their entire life for. They're selling their homes and their toys and taking out loans. And now the family is financially ruined forever. Or they become a felon, and now they're denied all kinds of employment opportunities and money-making opportunities. And maybe they don't go to prison, or they do go to prison, they lose their freedom, right? It's not just the self-defender who loses if there's a mistake that's made. It's their families and the others that care for them. So it truly is a gift, what you're talking about, what you learn from it, and what that simulator and our other training provides. The key component of it is for people to put their ego aside. I tell people that their ego is not their amigo. Mm. They need to put the ego aside, because as soon as you start saying, you have a self-defense gun, you need to train, they're like, listen, I've ran a gun since I was, 6 years old. I've been hunting and shooting soda cans off of fence posts, and they're very comfortable and confident with a gun. And they think that carries over into the real world with real bad guys that have real intent to commit evil acts. We're in a society with rules and laws. Their ego, a lot of times we see this a lot. They're like, I'm ready. I've got the gun. I've had a gun forever. And like, bud, you're not ready. There's a reason why law enforcement, military, and first responders train constantly. So that's a training.
So just looking at, so tell us a little, just for people out there listening to this, because it's really resonating with me. So tell us a little bit about what's available there through your training center, and what kind of courses, what you would recommend as an expert in this from both the training side and an awareness of protection. What should people do, and what's available through Forward Movement?
So really we really emphasize our shooting simulator. If you're local to the Valley, take an opportunity to do a session on the simulator and expose yourself to the potential of you not knowing what you think you actually know.
What's your website in case they're listening and want to write this down? Or
yeah, forwardmovementtraining.com. Yeah. Take live fire classes. We have a whole host. I mean, one of our instructors, he's got his PhD in clinical psychology. He does our warrior mindset, mental strength training. We have ladies night courses, which is just basic pistol familiarization for those that are brand new to this. We do basic through advanced live fire classes for pistol and rifle. And one of the things that we're really actually pretty excited about that we're just initiating is teaming up with a gal that is starting a company called Artemis, and she's housing it under the FMT umbrella, which is a national, even international, as it grows, female empowerment program through things like hunting and self-defense and archery and all components of real confidence building and empowerment in the outdoors. It's called Artemis. So that's something that's coming down the pipeline and we're excited about.
True. And what inspires you?
In what arena?
Everybody comes back at me with that these days.
So broad.
Personally, professionally, spiritually, what motivates you every day?
Leadership. Strong leadership is very inspirational to me. Strong leaders who know how to run a team. They don't have employees. They have team members. They inspire. They create. They allow others the autonomy to bring to the table their creative components of it. And leading an organization where they do it by example, but at the same time they demonstrate the qualities of understanding that they didn't rise to the top by themselves. It was a team that got them to the top. with them. So strong leadership is very inspirational to me. And I try to mimic, you know, other strong leaders that I appreciate and see as mentors.
Well, thank you, Matt. It's been great having you on. And a lot of what you said today, I know is going to help our listeners in a lot of different ways. So thank you for being here.
And thank you for listening. Strive for excellence, everyone.
You've been listening to the Inspire Excellence podcast. We invite you to find something that inspires you this week. Join us again for our next episode.